Hey everyone, my name is Mike Gibb. I run accountsrecovery.net, and I want to thank you for joining us today on this webinar on the topic of time-barred collection strategies. Collecting on debt where the statute of limitations has expired requires its own special skill set, and much to the chagrin of some consumer advocates, time-barred debt does not have to be a lost cause for collection agencies, creditors, or debt buyers. Today, a panel of credit and collection industry executives are with us to share their insights for navigating the waves of time-barred collection. This webinar is being generously sponsored by Microbuilt. You'll get the chance to hear about them a little later in our program. I want to take a quick minute and say a few words about accountsrecovery.net. Accountsrecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the credit collection industry. The site is free for anyone to use, and it's a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope everyone will spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Now, let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. Steve Fernstall is the president of Stoneley Recovery Associates, a debt recovery solutions company. Steven's responsible for the strategic initiatives, operations, and executive management. He's been actively involved in the credit collection industry for the past 27 years. Stoneley Recovery Associates is a mid-sized first and third-party debt collection agency that has been serving the industry for 11 years. Kelly Nepper-Stevens is Vice President of Legal and Compliance and Associate General Counsel for True Accord. Her work focuses on government regulation, compliance, and civil litigation. Kelly serves on the Board of Directors for the Receivables Management Association International and is an ACA certified instructor. She also served as a small entity representative for the arbitration and debt collection rulemakings. Her podcast, Two Dedicated Attorneys, can be found on Podbean. Collection Advisor Magazine named Kelly one of the 20 most powerful women in collections in 2018. Rick Purr is a partner with the law firm of Fineman, Craig, Stephen Harris, and a nationally recognized authority on creditors' rights, including the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and the Telephone Consumer Protection Act. Rick, who is ACA International, a trade association representing the debt collection industry, advises entities and individuals on matters related to compliance in the credit and collection industry, including review, implementation, and auditing of policies and procedures, especially in adherence with governmental regulatory bodies, such as the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The format for today's webinar will be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions, and we'll get to them as the discussion is ongoing and when the discussion has concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded, and a recording will be made available in the coming days on accountsrecovery.net. Finally, before we launch into today's discussion, I just want to ask everybody to please spare a minute and fill out the survey that should pop up on your screen after the webinar is over. You'll also receive a link via email tomorrow to access the survey. Participating in the survey helps me develop content that is what you're looking for and make sure that the speakers we have on these webinars are the ones you want to hear from, such as the panelists we have today. So please take a minute and fill that out when you get the link. With that, let's launch into today's discussion. And first, let's talk about what time-barred debt is and maybe how collecting on it is different than collecting on regular debt. Kelly, since your face is on the screen right now, maybe you get the honor of the first question.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Mike Gibb, for inviting me to participate with Rick and Steve. I'm very happy to be here. Time-barred debt is essentially debt that has passed the statute of limitations for the purposes of filing a lawsuit. So the debt is still valid and it's still owed, but the creditor to whom the debt is owed can no longer bring a lawsuit to recover on the debt. From a legal perspective, it's different than collecting on regular debt because there are certain obligations that a debt collector collecting on time-barred debt must meet. So the first would be written disclosures that are required to be placed on any collection letters or other communications that are sent on time-barred debt. The second would be oral disclosures, which would be some sort of statement that would have to be read by your collectors when they're speaking to a customer regarding their time-barred debt. And there have been several cases over the past many years, including consent orders that involve these types of disclosures. Certain states have special time-barred debt disclosures and requirements. So it's an area where you really need to understand your legal and compliance obligations in order to make sure that you're setting yourself up for success. Perhaps someone could address the operation.
I was just going to say, Kelly, it's important to differentiate the time-barred nature of filing a lawsuit, which, depending upon the type of the obligation, if it's a written or oral obligation, or certain states may have anywhere from a 2, 4, 6 year statute of limitations, in some cases for a breach of contract, whether in writing or not, different than the statute of what we call the statute of limitations. It's in the Fair Credit Reporting Act that allows an obligation to remain on someone's credit report for 7 years, 100 plus 180 days from the date of first delinquency. So I just wanted to clear up for any of our listeners that that would be a different aspect of debt collection. And as Kelly pointed out, this is just the statute of limitations for litigation purposes.
And I think, Rick, it's really good to distinguish the two, because the disclosures that are required generally are two different disclosures. And as an agency, you have to determine which disclosure is the one to put on your letter. And one disclosure is, this account is past the statute of limitations for the purpose of filing a lawsuit, but it can still be reported to the credit reporting agencies. And then the alternate disclosure is, this account is past the statute of limitations for the purposes of filing a lawsuit and cannot be reported to the credit reporting agencies. And so you have to have policies and procedures in place to be able to determine which one of those applies, and then make sure that you get it on your letter or get the script in front of your collector to read in the event that an oral disclosure is required. But I think, too, there are some operational questions, too, that I think Steve could speak to.
Yeah, I think that the largest challenge that we as an agency face when we're collecting portfolios that are time barred is the fact that on every communication, you have to advise them up front that it is past the statute of limitations. They cannot be pursued. So it opens up a narrative that you have to really appeal to their sense of pride rather than feeling obligated, because it basically relieves them of their obligation to pay it. There is no legal remedy at that point, and that's what you advise them. And it changes the tone of the conversation immediately.
Well, like I said, I believe I've seen, you know, consumer advocates who think that debt should be extinguished once the statute of limitations has expired. So, I think that even sort of, you know, is one factor why that the tone of that conversation changes. But when you say it's every conversation, does it become difficult to sort of, you know, how do you sort of skillfully work that into your script or into your, you know, into your narrative in that conversation?
Yeah, so you have to specially train your collectors to deal with this type of debt. You don't want just your general pool of collectors answering phone calls, such as the state of Wisconsin. You can't make a demand. It is against the law. You will get a lawsuit filed against you, most likely, if someone's calling about a Wisconsin debt and they're aware of their rights. It's usually a baiting call, which makes the situation kind of tumultuous, because every time that you're getting on the phone, there is a greater degree of risk involved with the communication. So you have to get your collectors really educated on the laws, make sure that your controls are in place and you're monitoring and retraining people that don't stick to exactly what's scripted out for them to say.
No improv.
And I think it's important in understanding that is sort of looking at what are the guidelines in terms of what states, what are the rules for particular states and with federal implications, and what categories do we end up with? And I think that what we see is that there are certain states out there, a handful, that say, in fact, you may not collect on time-barred debt. It's illegal. And doing so, even for the extent of accepting payment or otherwise, would be a violation of those states' laws. You have a category of states in which collecting on time-barred debt is permissive. States that I'm in, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, for example, even if the debt is time-barred, as Steve was saying, you know, with well-trained and well-versed people, you may communicate with them about paying in an honorable way, in an appropriate way, and that in these particular states, and I'll say, you know, divided up in circuit courts, right now there is no overarching circuit court opinion describing a specific disclosure or something else that you have to provide. And then there's the third group of states which allow for collection of time-barred debt with it, but that you have to make these actual disclosures. And that becomes tricky, as Steve noted, because there's a little bit of a dance. And we see on the litigation end, the way that the envelope is trying to be pushed. Use of words in conversations that for many of us have ordinary meaning are being twisted by plaintiff's attorneys to say, that's a threat of litigation. Using the word settlement, for example, which is a common word. Do you want to settle this debt in full? In fact, you know, the common abbreviation SIF, settle in full. However, plaintiff's attorneys make the attempt to try and say the use of settlement necessarily invokes imagery of litigation. Therefore, by saying settlement, you are in part threatening the potential of litigation, and thus you're in violation of threatening litigation on a time-barred debt. So, you know, training, clarity are critical because right now, plaintiff's attorneys are pushing the envelope of what words you can't use.
So I'd like to add on to that real quick because it's not an overarching situation from the courts that really we're viewing and trying to stay in line with. It's the consent orders from some of the past violations that have occurred and trying to read what the spirit behind what direction they're seeking for us to stay within, you know, the guidelines to be compliant with their expectations.
So Steve, if I could ask you, and it's a great point that you raise, how do you use that sort of analysis in terms of the changeover at the CFPB? You know, we've seen the prior administration, which sort of said, see what we say, but not see what we do, not what we say when it comes to interpreting the law. And then you have the current people in power at the CFPB that seem to say, consent orders are solely intended to be consent orders on the face between the parties that are involved. Don't read anything into it.
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not so concerned about the CFPB, BCFP, whatever they call themselves today. It's the state level attorney generals or the licensing department who are receiving the complaints. what their interpretation is, because I think that everyone has been noticing that it's really been shifting away from a centralized government, and all the states are kind of enacting their own Debt Collection Practices Act. So it creates some complexity. So we're kind of taking a more conservative approach and not trying to push the envelope with it.
Excellent. Well, at this point, I just want to pause. Sorry, Rick, let me interrupt for 1 second. I apologize. I just want to pause the discussion briefly and just talk a little bit about the sponsor for today's webinar. That's Microbuilt. For more than 35 years, Microbuilt has been helping businesses assess and manage risk. They were a pioneer in the now exploding alternative credit data space, and as such, have refined their products and services to deliver true business value. Over the years, Microbuilt has invested heavily in acquiring best-in-class data. They've built sophisticated systems for keeping their data fresh and accurate, and powerful predictive models for making decisions around lending, leasing, collections, and risk management. With Microbuilt, you can customize the products you need and how much you want to spend, and all their products are provided through a single, simple access portal. Whether you're working in originations or debt collection, screening a potential hire or tenant, planning for growth, or keeping up with regulatory requirements, Microbuilt can be your partner, providing the insight and information you need to protect your business, grow your bottom line, and keep your company running smoothly. For more information, please contact Microbuilt at 1-800-884-4747 or visit www.microbuilt.com. I apologize, Rick, I interrupted you. You were going to say?
No, I was just commenting. I found it fascinating that Steve's remarks on really taking a real hard-depth look at a state-to-state interpretation, is interesting in what I will say is the more of the absence of the CFPB being an active regulator in the debt collection space, a lot less active than it was just a few short years ago when it seemed that they were on the forefront. And you've had attorneys general and other regulatory bodies state to state take over that role. And it's interesting to see how that has transformed in the 2+ years since the change of administrations in Washington.
Well, I think that we can expect to see in the debt collection rulemaking anytime this spring, 2019, and you can enter the poll still on accountsrecovery.net and guess what day those rules might come out. But I think we anticipate them to require some sort of out of statute debt notice. And I think you kind of touched on it, Rick, when you were mentioning kind of the history of, or the evolution, if you will, of the out of statute language and case law and states that have gotten involved, because, you know, we had the asset acceptance consent order that came out in 2012 that required asset acceptance to put on, you know, either the notice that it was out of stat and you can't sue, or the notice that it was out of stat, you can't sue and it can't be reported. And then from there, we got into all of this trouble because we're, you know, agencies that are trying to do right by the consumer. Okay, we're going to put this notice on, even though we haven't been obligated to do so, in an effort to be forthright, you know, about the debt and the consumer's rights. And then, you know, more lawsuits came out about whether or not you need to add an additional sentence stating something about partial payment notice, because if a customer makes a partial payment in something like 28 or so states, that partial payment alone can retoll the statute of limitations and bring that account back in the statute of limitations so that a lawsuit could be filed. And that it would be misleading if you did not advise the consumer when you're collecting on an out of statute account in one of those jurisdictions where the partial payment alone could retoll the statute, that such a payment could retoll the statute. And so now folks have added that sort of notice based on the cases that have come out about that. And then the settlement cases, where if you're talking about the word entering into a settlement, that might confuse a consumer, which are pretty hyper-technical. So agencies have, you know, refined the notices that they're providing. They've removed the word settlement. Really, it's a good practice to just remove it from all letters and content so that you don't end up getting a lawsuit, you know, and use words like offer or whatever. And now we're seeing a lot of more lawsuits about whether or not you're giving that notice orally. Now, there's only a couple of states that require you to give the notice over the phone. And as Steve kind of mentioned, Massachusetts, New York, New York City, New Mexico, the states that require this like oral disclosure have a super long paragraph that you have to read to the customer. And after you get through the paragraph, I'm not sure they're still going to be on the phone because it's so long. So it kind of changes your strategy. But figuring out in the states that don't have a specific notice, what notice you're going to give. And if the state is a state where a partial payment retolls the statute and you have a payment IVR where, you know, the customer doesn't have to talk to an agent and can get to making a payment before talking to an agent, are you going to have some sort of out-of-stat disclosure on that payment IVR? You know, in Massachusetts, I think they would think that you would need to have that in order to specifically meet the requirements of their law. So, you know, that's the new thing is thinking about how you're handling it with collections over the phone and giving that notice.
So I want to kind of continue on that a little bit. I think the thing that worries me the most, why we keep it consistent across all the states is you don't, because of the portability of numbers, you don't know if a person has moved into another state and the number that's popping up is for a state that's not within the restricted states, but now they live in that state and now you violated their rights because you were just unaware that they'd moved. Or there's a possibility that the contract, the underlying contract that was written between the creditor and the consumer has a choice of law provision in a state that has a more restrictive viewpoint on it, and they have the decision to sue you in that venue.
Yeah, that's true. I think that if you have policies and procedures in place, kind of to provide you with some operating guidelines when that sort of happens, then you are setting yourself up to protect yourself from that sort of a lawsuit. So if you have a policy about consumers moving in the middle of the collection process such that, you know, they've moved from state A to state B, you know, what happens with the content and spelling out how that works so that you're going to be updating the content, that's important. But with the out of statute determination, you need to set up specific rules about that, right? So, you know, one rule that you might want to have is once out of stat, always out of stat. And you want to talk to your clients because you want to say, this is the rule I'm setting up. When a customer moves, doesn't matter if they move to a state where it stays out of stat, or even more problematic, if they move to a state where under that law, it wouldn't be beyond the statute of limitations. Once it's out of stat, we're always going to treat it as out of stat. Those rules, you know, what do you do with a partial payment in a state where the partial payment does not retoll the statute of limitations? You know, if you're working with a certified debt buyer who is, you know, living up to the RMA certification standards, a partial payment, they do not use a partial payment to retoll the statute. That's one of the RMA certification standards, once out of stat, always out of stat. So if you can address in advance, before you start working these accounts, these are the rules that we are going to follow so that everyone's on the same page and so that you have sort of an operating guideline, that's the best way to do it. And then hopefully your creditor will be the one that will be telling you when the account goes out of statute, because they're the ones that have access to the terms and conditions that may dictate a certain choice of law provision requiring the, you know, the law that applies to this contract is the law of the state of Nevada, right? So you'd use the statute of limitations from the state of Nevada as regardless of where the consumer is living. So those are the kind of things you definitely want to have worked out before you start taking these cases. I'm wondering, Steve, if you think, you know, or Rick, that it's worth it. Can you, you know, with the cost benefit analysis that you have to do, you know, is this something where you see reasonable net margins, if you will?
Over the past 10 years, they have shrunk considerably. Just, you know, there's actually a few reasons for that. The effectiveness of letters, for one thing, has decreased over the last 10 years. So you're not getting as many call-ins as you used to from sending out letters. The second thing is, I find that there is some ambiguity in reading some of these states, you know, interpretations of, you know, if it's an oral or if it's a auto, which timeline do you use? And I think that there's a different interpretation around the industry of, you know, when you read these to figure out where the cutoff date is and when it goes out of stat, there's some different interpretation. And when does it start the time running? You know, having your own interpretation, like Kelly said, having policies and procedures around it, showing that you've made the proper investigation into it and you're working by these set of rules and your interpretation is X with this, will go a long way if you run into a problem with it.
And you know, it's interesting that I heard both Kelly and Steve, you mentioned, you talk about letters and particularly, aren't we realistically though, in talking about communication with consumers, faced with the fact that the communication, I mean, letters are gone by the wayside. I think that probably, you know, 5 to 7 years from now, agencies are going to be doing far less in terms of letters. And it's going to be emails and texts and other types of, who knows, virtual communication that we haven't even invented yet. How do you put these things into these disclosures when you're having these communications in those formats? And some of the technology constraints that you have, and like, for example, leaving a drop voicemail message or sending a, you know, something that's recorded in a direction of somebody.
It's an interesting question, and I don't know if I have an answer for that today. Because there are so many issues that surround the out of statute debt itself, and the way you have to look at it is different than collecting debt that you know is within the statute of limitations. It's hard to give an explanation of what you would do with those technologies other than not utilize them, you know, because if you're talking about a text message, no one wants to receive a disclosure notice within their text message. So I think that might be a situation where it gets a little tricky. You know, the way I view it is it's we're a collection agency, and with a creditor, it's much different driving people to a website to consume information and get them using the technology. It's a situation where, you know, they're going online looking for information, usually to see who you are, not typically to just sign up and you know, disclose some of their information to you. So adopting technology is probably something that's going to be tricky for us going into the future to figure out a balance between what works and staying compliant within it.
So I've been given one time that I can tack on to Steve's answer. I'm going to take my opportunity and use this time right now. Steve's answer. I'm going to add that I think there are ways that you can use right now or be thinking about right now in terms of how am I going to convey this notice to a customer using modern forms of technology, right? So if you are sending consumers emails, you're going to want to make sure that an email is, that you're treating it, you know, very similar to a letter, and you're putting all the disclosures that you would need to put in writing in that email. So you're going to want those out of statute disclosures right there in your email, like you would in your letter. If you're texting with consumers because you have consent to use that form of communication with them, you know, you're probably going to be texting them because of the texting limit, some sort of a link that's going to take them somewhere else, right? So it'll have a little bit of what your initial communication is, but then, you know, when you're clicking on that link, then they're going to go to some page, and it's on that page that you need to make sure you're providing that out of statute notice. Because what the states and the regulators and the CFPB is concerned about is you not providing that notice to the consumer prior to getting them to make some sort of a payment on an account. So, you know, if you're sending them a text message that's, you know, reminding them about a payment arrangement that they've set up, when they click on that link, you know, through their phone, it should take them to a page where the out-of-statute notice is provided to them prior to them entering their payment information. And then I've been go ahead.
The first thing that comes to mind with that is this the communication? And when they hit on that link, is it a continuation of that communication? Or if they just read this message but don't click on the link, is that a violation because you did not provide them their disclosure information on the communication?
So, I mean, everyone obviously needs to consult with their, you know, inside or outside counsel before they make any decisions. What I would say here is that I think you have a pretty good case if, you know, the consumer is always going to see the language prior to them making some sort of payment. So I think that you can, you'd have a very good defense if someone's suing you about a text message you sent because the text message doesn't contain the disclosure, when the majority of the content that text message is directing the consumer to has that language in it. What would you say, Rick?
Well, it's interesting because I represent a couple of the text message people who are doing this in this space. And we talk about it in terms of even just doing, like you said, the state disclosures that you have to do. And then looking at the case law, you know, I think the hyperlink, you know, the case law says when you have disclosures that are on the back of a letter, if we try and imagine the text as a letter, of course, it's limited in scope. You know, it says you have to identify. It has to be clear and conspicuous if you're going to put something on the back of the letter for your backer. You have to put a notice clear and conspicuous that says there is important information on the other side of the letter, or please see important information. I think you got to do the same thing. I think that you can get away with it by putting it in the text as long as you create a hyperlink, not with a bunch of undecipherable letter number combinations that you click on, but actually say, click here, see here, or click here for more important information, just like you would do on a backer. And I think that satisfies it. And then they could click to a PDF or something that would put all the disclosures on there. Of course, this hasn't been tested anywhere in court, but it's the closest I can to analogize to how do you make the text comply in the same way that you make the letter comply if you were to visualize it in a physical way.
Very interesting viewpoint on it. One that I had not considered.
Yeah, and then I think, you know, you also have to think about the IVRs, because a lot of collection agencies are using IVRs. And if you're IVR is answering the phone, and the customer can direct themselves immediately to the payment area. You need to think about, for out of statute accounts, if that works, right? Are you going to put some sort of disclosure? Is there a way, like, is your IVR sophisticated enough to identify the account that is using the IVR and then provide the state specific out of statute disclosure before allowing that customer to make a payment? If not, you probably need to have your agents answering the phone, providing that disclosure, and then directing them to the payment IVR if the consumer is still interested in making a payment to resolve that account.
So a hypothetical question, say a consumer went in the state of Wisconsin to a self-service portal and made a payment on there. No demand was given. They just saw what the balance was. Would it make it okay to accept it in that fashion?
Yeah, so I think that's a great hypothetical. I don't think I'm continuing on an idea that you said, because you're asking a direct question, so I feel like this doesn't count against my total. And so I would say that with website payments and the self-serve portals that are out there, you're going to want to make sure that that state-specific language is there, that out-of-statute language is there in the portal, so that when the customer logs in, they see that notice. Even better, they check a box indicating that they read that notice, right? Like a box pops up that says your account is out of statute and then has the language, and then they check on it and then they can move forward, or however you want to set up your portal. But you definitely want to have that out of statute notice in a very conspicuous area, right around or near where that customer is making a payment. And I think it's I think it's New York City, their out of statute notice is required to be in a different color font, and it's required to be located at or near where you're demanding the payment. So I think that that is a pretty good sense of direction on what regulators would be thinking and consumer plaintiffs attorneys about where a fair location is on your website for this out of statute notice. What do you think, Rick?
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't know if it was Steve or Mike who mentioned it in passing. I'm not exactly sure that in terms of, what consumer attorneys are looking to do and what consumer advocates are looking to do, other than to completely stop the collection of time-barred debt. I don't think they'll be happy until it's a prohibited conduct. And I think everyone needs to look at the suggestions that you've made and try and put it in all of these places and do and try and mimic everything you're supposed to do, but knowing that there is a group of people out there who just want to sue to try and restrict the collection of time-barred debt as much as they possibly can, and use the court system to the extent that the regulators don't do it themselves. So I agree with you, Kelly, in trying to match those type of things and putting it on the page and following all those conditions. But just understand that there will be a lawsuit or two from somebody somewhere along the way, because that's just what they do.
Yeah, for sure. And they've won the argument when they when the NCLC wrote the report about zombie debt. I've mentioned before that classifying it as zombie debt really paints a picture for the American public that doesn't look good, right? And people aren't thinking about, the fact that in certain states, maybe the account is, 3-4 years old, they still have the benefit of the goods or the, credit that they received. It can still be reported on their credit reporting or their credit report, And so it's real tough because, people think of out of statute debt, it's 20-year-old debt. And that's not necessarily the case. The majority of states, I think the average is somewhere around 5 for the statute of limitations. So I think what will happen, and I think that there are some, economic statistical reports that are starting to show this in states that have, adopted these sort of language disclosures and other, earlier statute of limitations. I think West Virginia a couple of years ago changed their law to 4 years. Whether or not we're seeing creditors start to sue to, get a judgment on that account earlier than they would have had they not had to comply with all those laws, because they want to protect, their investment, and they want to be able to still recover on it when the consumer has had the opportunity to dig themselves out of the hole that they got in and is ready to start, making payments on that account. And we all know it can take consumers a couple of years after an unfortunate, circumstance, that led to them getting into debt to recover from.
Yeah, so I was going to say the exact same thing.
Go ahead,
Steve. The life cycle where a consumer rebounds, you have a lot of the states that, especially in the area of credit cards and open-ended loans, where you're talking about 3 years. And if it's from the date that they originally stopped paying, they might go through an illness for 2 years, take another couple months to get back on their feet with a job. And, the last thing they're worried about at that very moment in time is a past due credit card. But another 2 years down the road, I don't believe that for the majority of people, they go around not honoring the debts that they've created. It's a situation where, people do want to pay. And what we run into with out of stat is it's usually people just want to pay their obligation and they have the means to do it at this point in their life. I think some of the statute's limitations do encourage probably premature filing of lawsuits that could have waited a little while longer and not had to make the consumer incur additional expense as a result of it.
Well, but it's interesting, that and listening to both of you talk about it, are we on the verge of a little bit of be careful what you ask for? Let's assume that consumer attorneys get a universe of time barred, no collection of time barred debt. Yeah, let's assume that that becomes a universal event across all 50 states and the District of Columbia and all of our territories and everything along those lines. Are we going to end up with a collection world a couple years from now, 5 years from now, where there will be specialists in both facilitating the conversion of this paper into judgments? And as we all know, the statute, quote, statute of limitations on a judgment is, for all intents and purposes, non-existent, other than the renewal of the judgment every once in a while, depending upon state to state, that you're going to submit a whole bunch of people to either defending litigation or defaulting by not showing up, and then having the creditors be able to sit on the paper, sell the paper, or do what they need to do to make sure that this stuff doesn't go by the wayside.
Right, like garnish.
Yeah.
No, maybe the cry out there is for the three of us and others to start up some entity that's going to be able to do all that to anticipate the world that's going to be in front of us.
Yeah, so there's already outlets, but the consumer rights advocates are crying on the other end because the courts are getting clogged up with all of these lawsuits and. If you've been to court and watched how the proceedings go, it is just a it's you know, one case after another with an attorney standing there in front of the judge just going through case after case. So I think it's harmful to our court system because it's going to, you know, without much need for it at this point, clog up the court system with additional litigation against consumers because it is a financial instrument. And once it's reduced to a judgment, it has far more value than a, let's just say, an oral or a open-ended situation where it's a, say, a revolving credit card, right? You're typically getting some type of interest on it that's awarded by the court, and it's maturing. So, I absolutely see that they will circumvent and, you know, shorten their life cycle of how long agencies keep the debt in a contingency environment and move to a legal strategy much sooner in the process.
I mean, do you see at all the remote possibility that creditors are just going to just say, okay, wipe our hands, we got 3 years to do something. If we don't, you know, in lieu of reducing these to judgment, we're just going to let the paper lapse? I mean, is that a realistic possibility?
I mean, a percentage of it you will allow to lapse. And it's, you know, I always viewed social sciences as being the weakest of the sciences. And then, you know, you read about how Target discovered this girl that was pregnant before her father knew, right? It's hard when you look at a data set that is meant to be spread out across a population of people and, you know, whittle it down to saying this is what that person is. We're a lot closer now than we were 5 years ago. And, you know, the artificial intelligence that is available at a pretty low cost and, you know, a low threshold to set up, it is conceivable that they'll just allow the accounts that they don't believe to be worth pursuing because there is a cost involved. And if they never pay, it's impossible to recuperate those expenses. But on the flip side is, you know, you have a higher propensity for someone to pay once that judgment is established. So it's hard to say. I guess it's going to be based on their risk tolerance.
Well, it'll definitely be interesting because, you know, I hold the opinion that people usually don't throw money away and they'll find a way to monetize it in some way, shape, or form. Yeah, they didn't get to be banks and other entities by doing it. You may see a little bit on the $40 deductibles for healthcare from mom and pop medical offices that aren't gonna, you know, waste the time to reduce those to judgments. But you know, bigger surgical ones, maybe student loans, perhaps. Well, there's no, it's this federally backed student loans don't have a statute of limitations, but. You know, campus tuition accounts, things of that nature.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we went through a very large boom where debt collection attorneys were very in vogue, and then they kind of fell out of fashion for a while. But I think that's really starting to surge back up again. I think there was a lot of concern around the treatment of consumers.
Excellent. Well, let me just jump in for a minute and remind everybody we've got less than 10 minutes left in our time for today. So if you have a question for Kelly, Steve, Rick, or all of them, now would be the time to type it in. to your Zoom webinar control panel and send it to us. And in the means of sort of jumpstarting people to do that, there's one question I want to ask. With the current amount of hyper-technical violation lawsuits being filed against agencies, do you feel that the risk-reward and cost-benefit scales make it viable to actively seek out this type of portfolio, especially when there's so much in statute debt out there?
Can I answer this?
Absolutely.
So, it all depends what the treatment path was before that. If you have a file that has just received a blanket settlement offer to all of the consumers at 20%, and it just went through tax season, and you're getting it right after that, and you're working on a contingency basis, I would say no, absolutely, you are going to be taking a loss on it. On the flip side, though, if it has been warehoused, if there's been very low incidences where, settlement offers were provided to the consumers, and if they were mass settlement offers that they were at a threshold that was high, that still left enough, population in there to pay, it could turn out to be a very good situation. So really understanding from a background perspective, the treatment path of where, your consumer has been when it's hitting your office will go a long way with helping you understand if this is going to be a profitable venture for you or not. If you walk into it blindly, I wouldn't expect to be successful working this type of debt, and using some type of scoring methodology that is specific to out-of-state debt would be very helpful, tying in different associations and not just using like an Experian or a TransUnion scoring model, but also using some of the attribute levels, some of demographic information. That's usually helpful in understanding, what segments of population you have that that may be outliers that, will pay.
And I would also say that depending on what's left of the credit reporting statute of limitations, there may be some motivation for you to be passive with the actual collection efforts, i.e. letters, phone calls, if you're concerned about hyper-technical lawsuits, and just putting things on the credit report. And if you still got 1 year or 2 years or even 3 years left on the credit reporting time period, it may be advantageous for you to just sit back, cast something on someone's credit report, and wait for them to call up. I mean, inevitably, today's world, with access to credit reports and the need to be credit worthy in so many different areas, there's a lot of people that will notice things and be driven to communicating to you about a desire to get it off the report. And while they may have no obligation to pay it from a statute of limitations purposes, they may have a desire to get it removed for a credit reporting statute purpose.
As you're saying that, Rick, I'm thinking that the CFPB put something out there regarding that in either their supervisory highlights or perhaps one of their bulletins regarding credit reporting, with a concern about this like parking of something on someone's credit report. And I think, definitely a lot of the inbound calls that you're going to get on out of statute debt are going to be when the consumer has gotten themselves back into a, better financial position. They are now, looking to lease a car, buy a car, buy a house, and they're cleaning up, their credit report now that they're out of their hole. And so they'll be coming to you. So making sure that when you're doing that you have good policies and procedures in place and are sending out that initial demand letter, as ways to let the consumer know how to get in touch with you are good practices.
Excellent. Another question, getting a CBR dispute for past stat accounts from a credit reporting agency, is there any obligation to respond since this isn't a direct dispute from a consumer?
Well, if you're under, if you're a data furnisher, 1681 S2A requires you, even on a direct dispute, to respond. It's not enforceable in a private cause of action. It's enforceable by governmental entities. But nevertheless, under S2A for a direct dispute, you still have the legal obligation to respond to any dispute and to conduct a reasonable reinvestigation. Under 1681 S2B, which is a dispute that would go through the credit bureaus and be relayed to you via format such as eOSCAR, you have, again, an obligation to do a reinvestigation of the dispute, address whatever the dispute is. And under that section of the Fair Credit Reporting Act, you can be sued in a private cause of action. I would think that regardless of either methodology that's used to communicate with you about a dispute, you investigate whatever the dispute is, you respond to the person, and that you mark the credit bureau with what is the common definition of the fact that on the credit report that the consumer disputes this debt. So that is notated as well. So you avoid a E8 obligation under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. But,
I was just wondering if I could get clarification on the question, because it seemed as if they were asking if they needed to respond based on someone just saying that the account was out of statute. Is that correct?
In reading the question, it says getting a CBR dispute for a past stat account from a credit reporting agency. Is there any obligation to respond since this isn't a direct dispute from a consumer?
And I would say that the answer is the same that Rick provided.
Yeah.
That the best practice in order to meet your requirements would be to make sure that you are responding to disputes however you get them.
So I guess it also depends if you're getting the response from the credit bureau and it's in a state that you cannot report, it would be best to get it off and do your best to respond and get that cleared up.
Yes. Absolutely.
Well, we've just about run out of time, but before I let our panelists go, what I'd like to do is maybe go around and give each of them a chance to summarize their remarks or talk about something that they didn't get a chance to say but wanted to share with the audience, or just a chance to make some final comments. Rick, would you mind going first? Is Rick still there? Oh, I think we lost Rick. Sorry. Steve, how about you?
You know what? I felt it was like a campfire chat. It's a lot of back and forth banter. I don't know if there's anything that I would have to add to it. It's it's just something that you have to make the decision based on your own risk tolerance. But I would caution anyone that does go into this, understand all of the laws and what the expectations of your representatives are, and make sure you enforce them, because you can find yourself in trouble very quickly if you don't have the proper policies and procedures in place.
Fully agree. Well said. Thanks for having us, Mike.
Excellent. Well, with that, we'll wrap up for today. Kelly, Rick, if you can still hear us. Steve, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. You guys did an awesome job. Thanks again to MicroBuilt for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to microbuilt.com to learn more about the company. Again, a final reminder, please take a second and fill out the survey once this webinar is over or when you get the email tomorrow. And with that, I'll let everybody go and enjoy the rest of the day. Panel, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. We'll talk to everybody soon.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.